I'm really, really happy to be here. And I love this conference. Don't you love this conference?
Yeah.
I was telling my husband that I've learned so much, and actually, no kidding, more than my traditional conferences, EPI conferences, because I'm forced to listen to wonderful people who are working in other areas. So I hope to come back, and I hope there's more of this integration across disciplines, because I think it's what the field needs, and it's certainly what I need. So I'm not sure my title is exactly right, but that's okay. It's a placeholder. What I want to start with is talking about a pretty important event in my life, which was this article that appeared in August of last year. This is, I made a Newsweek cover, happy to say. But that, aside from this, this was a really widely circulated, you could almost say went viral, this story. And what we reported was that in a very large meta-analysis of published studies of sperm decline, we had seen a very significant decline in sperm quality in primarily Western countries, and it looks like this. So it's a boring headline: temporal trends in sperm count, a systematic review and a meta-regression. Well, that sounds terribly boring, but it's actually not boring at all, because what we showed was that sperm count had declined more than 50% in only 38 years among men from Western countries, and it's not getting better. So it's interesting, because this is not the first time that this story was published. It's the first time this paper was published, but this is actually not a new story. And in 1992, a group from Denmark published a pretty similar finding. How many people have heard of this study? 1992? Not too many of you, right? Evidence for decreasing quality of semen quality during the past 50 years. So when this was published, it did not have the impact that our paper did, but it had a pretty big impact. And it was actually slammed quite a bit. And there were all these people that were denying it and criticizing it and writing it off. Some people were taking it seriously. I personally was skeptical. Did I do something wrong? No, you can still hear me? Okay. I personally was skeptical. It doesn't look actually very impressive. And it's not a very big paper. It's like 2.5 pages. And I had the opportunity to spend some time looking into this as part of my serving on the Committee for Endocrine Disruption for the National Academy of Sciences. And they said, "What, is there anything in this?" And I said, I don't think so, but let me look at it. And I actually spent half a year doing that. And what I did was go back into the data, 61 studies that had been behind this, and tried to look at all the things that people have said could explain it. So, different method of counting sperm, that must be it. We're counting differently now. Different men, well, now we have more subfertile men in the populations. More obese men, or smokers, and so on and so forth. There were all these confounders and biases that people said would make this go away. And so my job then was to make this trend go away. But didn't. I published a series of studies. I'm not going to show you the second one. The third one was published in 2000, and what I did in this one was do my own literature review. I got 101 studies. The time period is extended now to 1930 to 1960, so it's longer. And I separated geographic regions. So I looked at Western countries, non-Western countries, actually separated Europe and North America, and then the rest. And this is something that is important to remember. The small line on the right, I'm not going to use a pointer because I could use a pointer. I guess I can't use a pointer. The small line on the right is other countries, not North America, not Europe. What you should notice there is there's not much of a line, and in fact, there's not very many studies. So to do a sperm study, you have to have a certain level of technology. You have to have a lab. You have to have also people who are willing to give you samples. So there's a lot of things that have to be in place to do these studies. And this is mostly, this was mostly in North America and Europe. But I want you to see that if I go back to that slope and to this slope, now look here. Here we have four lines, not three. And they're not the same as the three that I showed you before. What we did in this study, we made two divisions. Western, non-Western, and selected, unselected. And this is the first study to do the selected, unselected. What does selected, unselected mean? The unselected are men who did not know anything about their fertility and therefore could have not self-selected them into the study because they had good or bad fertility. It ruled out bias of that kind, selection bias. And the other men were the fertile men who were fathers. So they're different. They're already proven a certain level of sperm count. And so we feel that our primary finding is on unselected men from Western countries where the most information was. And that's the steep blue line. And that is actually steeper than the Carlson line. And it is steeper than this line if you put Europe and the North America together. Basically, what I want to show you is that nothing has changed. And so at this point, with the publication of our study in last August, there are very few people now who are saying there has not been a decline. It's a little bit like climate change. At the beginning, people said, no, hasn't really changed. And if it did, it wasn't due to us. And then gradually they said, well, probably has changed, but it's not due to us. So that's where we are here. People are now saying, yeah, it's declined, but it's nothing to do with chemicals we've made or anything that we've done. This has to do with something else. So I'm going to talk about that something else now, okay? What is it that we, or chemicals, that could have caused any of these declines? Because they're not different. It's just a very consistent pattern of sperm decline at a significant rate, and it has a lot of impacts. One impact is on fertility. Now, this is a slim graph, and I would have loved to show you an interactive, and you can go to World Bank and see this yourself. It's a beautiful website. Here's the website here. But what this shows, fertility, the number of children born to a couple, has gone down basically by 50% along the time period that we studied. Sperm decline and fertility have declined at the same rate. There's a line there, 2.1, that's replacement. That means that a couple will replace themselves. And we are now, in many parts of the Western world, quite a bit below replacement. Europe is 1.6. There are several countries, particularly in the Far East, that are 1.2. So it's getting tricky. It's getting tricky to think about how we're going to keep going if that decline keeps going. And that's always the question. It's going to turn around. It's going to get better. We saw no evidence for that. We did our analysis for the last 20 years, the last 10 years. It was always the same slope. There is no evidence of a tapering off of this decline. So this idea that human fertility is challenged and that we may not be able to continue in the same way has captured the public imagination and the literary imagination. There's P.D. James' Children of Men. There's Margaret Atwood's A Handmaid's Tale. And I put this up here because the handmaids were the women who delivered the children. They were the surrogates. if you will. And if we look at surrogacy in the United in the world, this is increasing rapidly. These are the number of gestational carrier cycles, surrogates or gestational carriers, increasing from 1999 to basically the present. This is a similar slope to the decline. So just putting that out there provocatively, that this is a concern. There's also the number of total cycles through in vitro is increasing rapidly. So this is the number of cycles through artificial insemination. So by any measure, fertility and particularly male reproductive function is not in good shape. Possible causes. Chance, there's really three. Chance, bias, confounding, methodological issues, genetics, environment. So I think that we have ruled out chance. We have replicated the study multiple times. We have shown consistent trends which support the study. And it's a very big study. Okay, we screened 5,000 papers and ended up summarizing 185 studies of 42,000 men. I mean, this is a mega study. Genetics, too fast. Environment has to play a role. So now let's get in deep and think about when this is likely to be happening. So these are rodent pups, and they are sitting in the uterine horn, and each of these little pups is affected by the by the sex of their neighbor and the hormones secreted by their neighbor. This is called the intrauterine position effect. It was discovered by Fred von Saal in the 80s. It's still extremely important. And one of the things to know is that, for example, a female that's between two males will get a little bit of testosterone, a tiny bit of testosterone, which will cause her reproductive tract development to be altered, and also her behavior. So how much is that? It's about one drop in a swimming pool. That's the concentration of extra testosterone that is given to the female by that male. So we're talking about low doses, and we're talking about low doses that could plausibly be in the kind of products that we've been talking about all day. We're talking about this molecule, testosterone, and I couldn't, you know, listening to the talks today and thinking about this talk and so on, I'm struck over and over again that this is a male story. This is a story about adverse effects on the male, whether it's Tyrone's frogs, whether it's Vicky's fish. There are impacts on the male. We haven't heard about females hardly at all here, right? We're talking about testosterone and the depletion of testosterone at a critical developmental period. So here is the undifferentiated human, very schematically, genital tract, and without androgen, this is the female genital tract, and in the present with the presence of the right amount of testosterone at the right time, you'll get the male typical development. So if you think about this, anything that will come into the system and reduce testosterone at the time that this differentiation is occurring can mess this up. You with me? This is the danger point right here. So what can lower testosterone? Well, we call them antiandrogens. And one big class of antiandrogens is the phthalates that I've been studying for about 20 years. And there are others. We've had a lot of talk about phthalates. I don't have to show you a lot of phthalates except to point out that they are in our daily lives. And this baby in the NICU is particularly important for this research because those tubes that's putting nutrients and into the baby are is those nutrients are going through a plastic tube. The phthalate in that tube, which is in there to make it soft and flexible, that is not chemically bound. That comes out, particularly in there's something warm going through the tube. So there have been several studies that have measured in the urine of these children the phthalates and shown them to be directly related to how many lines were going into the baby. Shower curtains, just one example of something in our home, and of course in our personal care products. And for the chemical that I'm most concerned about, which is diethyl hexylphthalate, a lot of it in our food, and we've heard about that. And we've also heard about the fact that this woman reading this package, trying to figure out whether this product is safe for her, maybe as a pregnant woman, can't tell. She can't tell. And she shouldn't have to. So why do I say that DHP, for example, is an anti-androgen? And what do I mean by a critical window? So this is a schematic. There is an unexposed mom. There is a fetus, or small mouse, a pup, if you will. And gestational day 19 to 21, there will be this surge of testosterone produced by the fetal testes, unexposed. However, when the mother is exposed to diethyl hexylphthalate, at around that time, the surge is suppressed. This is anti-androgenic action. Okay? This is not what you want in happening in the body of your son that you're carrying as a pregnant woman. So what else can DEHP do? It produces a cluster of effects, which is known as the phthalate syndrome. I'm going to talk a little bit and then a little bit more about anogenital distance, which is a measure which has been used in rodents for about 100 years to sex them. What does that mean? That means you get the pups, you decide this one is a female, short AGD, put it in this basket. This one is a long AGD, put it in the male basket, probably throw away the females and work on the males. DHP causes the male to have a shorter anogenital distance, a smaller penis, malformations of the penis, undescended testicles. So this was identified in 2000. By Foster and Gray. Here is the anogenital distance. This is a Fred Bonsall slide. You see the long male anogenital distance, and I wish I could, oh, I can, okay, good. So, anus, genitals. Now, in the rodent, it's pretty easy. There's just one point that's the genitals. Humans is a little more complicated. So we have several possible measures of this anogenital distance. But for rodents, it's simple. And here's the female. And you can see it's quite a bit shorter. So I was flying to Japan with a colleague from CDC, John Brock. And he said, Shauna, you should study phthalates. What? This was about 2002, and phthalates had just been successfully measured by CDC, and it had been demonstrated that they were in everybody, and Foster and Gray had published the phthalate syndrome. And so I thought, I could do that. I could, in my study, where I had saved, for reasons I didn't know, urine in pregnant women, I could measure phthalates in the urine. I could bring the babies back and look for this anogenital distance. How to do that wasn't so clear. No one had done it. But it's not rocket science. And I did it. So I wanted to see what happens if a small amount of an antiandrogen, okay, like DHP, is introduced into the fetal environment, preferably at the right time. And what we found in our women, what we asked in our women in this first study, if we have a mid-pregnancy urine sample and we measure the testicular descent and we measure the penile width and we measure the anogenital distance and the scrotal size, will we see a change associated with the urine levels of phthalates? So that's the program. And we did that. We did it twice in two studies because it's good to replicate. And what we found was that, in fact, the phthalate syndrome was measurable in human male infants. Okay? We found the phthalate syndrome in human male infants. This was really important because we had now definitive, maybe not definitive, but hopefully somewhat convincing evidence that phthalates could interrupt fetal androgen in a way that we could measure in the boys. Nothing in the girls, by the way. No changes in the girls. Does this matter if you have a short AGD? Who cares? If you look at these boys with a short AGD, they don't look weird. We didn't actually see any malformations. So it wasn't, we're talking about small effects from a small exposure at the individual level. But the question is, what does that mean for the population? And Michael Eisenberg is an andrologist in Stanford. He measured AGD in adult men coming in to an infertility clinic. And what he showed was that childless in red, short AGD, fathers in green, long AGD. Very significant difference in fertility associated with AGD. Jaime Mendiola and I did it in Rochester, New York, in young men. We found that sperm count, higher sperm count, longer AGD, shorter sperm count, lower sperm count, shorter AGD. So now we have a link to the first slide. Here is something that plausibly could be playing a role in that sperm decline. I'm not at all saying it's the only cause. I'm saying that's probably a cause. But we have a lot of chemicals in our bodies, and we have a lot of work to be done to show that they're related to sperm count, but we now have a program to work on. I love this slide. Plastics, an important part of your healthy diet. This message, along with better living through chemistry, was given to the Western population, I think, not just the United States, that these plastics would make our life better, and in many ways they have. Many ways they have. But not in the ways that we're talking about today, and probably not in relation to sperm count. You've seen something like this. There are 84,000 chemicals in household products. 200 have been tested, not for endocrine disruption. And only 5 have been regulated. That's from the NRDC. So we have seen some discussion of regrettable substitutes. I just want to stress that I told you I replicated the study on AGD. The first study, we enrolled women in 2000 to 2002. The second study, 2010 to 2012, 10 years, right? In that 10 years, DHP in our women's urine dropped 50%. It's amazing. That's a great thing. But DINP, which has the same effect on AGD, went up. It's very, very frustrating to me as an epidemiologist. What do I have to do now? Start a whole new study, get another $5 million grant, start measuring DINP, and showing it's harmful. And it's not going to stop there. If you look at the polybrominated diphenyl ethers. They were replacing the polybrominated biphenyls, which were replacing the triphenyl phosphates. I mean, it's just they're just going to go on until we, unless we change the program, as Terry is trying to do. Meanwhile, I say to you that we are like these animals in cages. We are part of a massive experiment to which we did not give our permission. Neither did these people, these creatures. They did not give their permission. And all of these species here, as you know, because we had wonderful talks on them this morning, have their reproductive function impacted by environmental chemicals. Many of the same chemicals that we know impact us, and many of the similar changes. I was very surprised to hear this morning that something called the testicular dysgenesis syndrome, which is a syndrome similar to the phthalate syndrome, but broader because it has cancer and so on, testicular cancer, that is seen in bats. I'd never seen it in non-mammalian species. So we're all in this together. There's no reason to think that these guys, who some of whom are going extinct, are different from us. And so the question is this: could the drop in sperm count make humans extinct? I leave that to you as an unanswered question. Thank you.
We have time for one question.
What? Great. Thank you. Wonderful talk. Really fabulous. So the sperm itself, is it of such a lower, could it be a lower quality so that the humans that are being reproduced are lesser than their predecessors? So our grandfathers will be supermen and grandmothers superwomen, and the next generation are going to be a bunch of weaklings.
A provocative question. Certainly there are impacts on other aspects of sperm production, motility, morphology, sperm DNA, and so on. There's no doubt that these things are correlated and there's a decrease. Our study did not look at those because it would be too huge a study. That would be another meta-analysis. But it's not a good picture, and I should tell you that men with low sperm count are not just suffering from low sperm count. Men with low sperm count die earlier, they have a shorter lifespan, and they have higher, and I'm not making this up, there's several papers on this, it just sounds so shocking, but it's true. They have a shorter lifespan, and they have higher morbidity in areas of cardiac disease, cancer, and diabetes. So I think, Bill, you're right that there's impacts way beyond the sperm.
Thank you very much, Shana.